The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
When I was also a moment in my younger days as a student, I happened to be in the library looking for another book, and my eyes fell upon some lectures, of which I knew nothing, that had been given by Abraham Kuyper at Princeton. These were his lectures on Calvinism. And so I simply took the book home and was enthralled by it, and a little later was talking to one of my profs, who then said to me, well, if you liked Kuyper's book, you will love James Orr's book, A Christian View of God and the World. So I went to the library and I got that too. And none of this had anything to do with any of my courses, which is a melancholy lesson that professors sooner or later all have to learn, that some of the most interesting things that happen in student minds have nothing to do with their classes. But so it was, by this happy circumstance, that I encountered these two volumes, Kuyper's Lectures on Calvinism, Orr's A Christian View of God and the World. These two volumes that have proved to be so seminal and so important in defining, at least in the 20th century, this idea of a worldview, which, as you all know, is and always has been a characteristic Reformed interest. Thinking worldviewishly is what Reformed people do. But of course, we are reminded almost every day in this postmodern ethos where we find ourselves that this is something that we can no longer do. The idea of a worldview is said to be impossible. Impossible, postmoderns say, because the scaffolding that you need for it, a particular epistemology and a particular view of reason and indeed a view of the world as objective, these things have all fallen apart. So worldviews are not possible. In his introduction to Postmodern Theologies, Ray Griffin observes that the postmodern disposition, and I'm quoting him, it eliminates the ingredients necessary to a worldview, such as God, self, purpose, meaning, a real world, and truth as correspondence. Now, there obviously are a whole nest of considerations here, and I can't take them all up in the remaining 45 minutes maximum that I have, but I do want to take up one or two of them. And I do so because I'm sure that you are aware that today we are in the midst of a struggle which is of a worldview kind. We are engaged in a worldview struggle in this postmodern context, a struggle which has many particulars, but which in fact goes to the very heart of the way that we think about everything. And so, first of all, I want to begin by picking up very briefly this idea of a worldview, and then secondly, I want to look at one of the key components of it, namely the view of ourselves as knowing and experiencing subjects. And then thirdly, I want to make the argument that in our current discussion on this particular point, the way in which postmoderns have been distancing themselves from moderns, from Enlightenment types, is a tad fallacious. And my conclusion will be that we can and should think in terms of a worldview, a Christian worldview, grounded in the Word of God and sustained by the veracity of God, and one that gives us a place, as it were, to stand cognitively in the midst of our rapidly changing, shifting world. So that's what I want to try to do. First, and very briefly, the idea of a worldview. When Kuyper gave his lectures at Princeton, he made the argument that a worldview, what's entailed is bringing about a coherent relationship between three aspects of our understanding. And these are, as he put it, our relation to God, our relation to man, our relation to the world. And then he went on to elaborate on these, as you might expect, and very quickly, with respect to God. Christian faith begins with the recognition of creation as separate from the Creator, subject to Him, deriving its life from Him, sustained by Him, meaningless, separated from Him. And he contrasted this with other views, such as, for example, paganism that confuses Creator and creation, Islam, which he argues separates them. Human beings, their greatness being the fact that they're made in the Imago Dei, the wretchedness being its corruption by sin. And the world being the domain still of God's sovereign control, not least as he restrains sin by his common grace, and even allows those who are non-regenerate, if I can quote Kuyper, to discover the treasures and develop the potencies hidden by God in nature and in human life. So, begin with these three points, and it's not that difficult to see how a worldview begins to emerge from it, because a worldview is a conceptual framework. It's a conceptual framework that arises from these clusters of consideration that Kuyper identified. It is our understanding of reality based upon our knowledge of God, ourselves as created in His image, and this creation as sustained and sovereignly ruled by Him. Now, it's true that worldviews are general and not particular. And of course, it is at the level of the particulars where we oftentimes have our differences. And indeed, sometimes it's at the level of the particulars where those having the same kind of worldview have their fiercest conflicts. But I don't think that that itself is a reason to give up this whole notion of worldview. But today, this matter of worldview and the possibility of it is, of course, under siege. If I can go back, revert to Kuyper's points, the three points that sort of locate the corners of our conceptual work, a notion of what is ultimate, understanding ourselves as knowing and experiencing subjects, and the nature of the world as experienced. Now, remove any one of these, or if any one of these becomes impossible or unknown or doubtful, then the whole matter of a conceptual framework we call a worldview begins to fall apart. So I could pick up any one of these, but I actually want to pick up the second of his points, namely thinking of ourselves as knowing and experiencing subjects. Now, in our postmodern ethos today, there are certain given moves that are typically made. First, the argument is that we cannot, in fact, escape our subjectivity. That second, reason is usually a ruse for our lust for power of one kind or another, and therefore cannot be trusted. And that the world outside of us cannot be objectified in such a way that we can know it objectively. Well, these are the arguments that some postmoderns have been making. These are the arguments intellectuals make. Now, when you look in the broader culture, matters are, I think, a little murkier. They usually are a little murkier. But if you look in the broader culture, and over quite a length of time, I think it is possible to trace what in Western cultures has been an almost epoch-making transformation in the way that we think about ourselves. And I have broken it down into four very simple steps. In the West, and not just in the last few years, but over the last two centuries or so, in the West, there has been a move in the wider culture of thinking or of moving from thinking about ourselves in terms of nature to self, thinking of from virtues to values, the third shift from character to personality, and the final shift from guilt to shame. Let me quickly take these up. For centuries in the West, people have talked about human beings in terms of human nature. And in the Christian part of that discussion, human nature made in the image of God. And the point of it was that beneath all of the diversity that is undoubted and real and indeed valued, the diversity of age, of ethnicity, of culture, and so on, beneath all of that diversity, there is something which is identifiably human and which distinguishes us from mere animals. A kind of unchanging constitution, so that we generalize about human beings. Oh, you know what human nature is like, we might have said. But increasingly, in one form or another, or in one language or another, nature has fallen into disrepute, and talking about human nature has become offensive. And slowly, first in the academy, but then in the wider culture, we have moved to thinking about the self. So it's a transition from nature to self. Now, the point about this is that human nature, at least as we used to think about it, is common to all human beings. The self is something that is unique. Nobody else has myself, because myself is at the juncture, it is at the point of integration between my ethnicity, cultural background, my own private insights, my own personal narrative, my own education, what I know, what I think about, who I have known. All of those things feed into what is a unique set of perceptions which are mine, and nobody else has them. Is this not what we teach our kids in the school system? Every child is unique. And every unique person, therefore, has unique perceptions of reality. Now, let me say again, this has been going on for a long time in the West. To think of this as purely a postmodern discovery is really to make a big mistake. Second, the shift, first of all, from nature to self. Second, the shift that where we once valued character and we now value personality. Had you asked anybody prior to the 20th century about personality, they probably would have looked at you a little blankly. The fact is that personality, as we think about it today, really was a 20th century creation. And it's one that, of course, has been given special traction in our video culture. I mean, if you take television, for example, the most important thing about television is that you be likable. Whether you have integrity and you're a morally upright person is irrelevant if you're likable. And forgive me for saying it, but I suspect that this has entered the church too, where churches look for pastors, and the premium is if they are likable. And whether they are people of theological and biblical substance is not quite so important. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting the opposite, that if you're a person of biblical and theological substance, that you can afford not to be likable, which happens. But in our culture, personality always trumps character. The third shift that we have made has been from virtues to values. In the 19th and 20th centuries, virtues were aspects of the good. The good understood as what was absolute and morally normative, however it was derived. And there is a lot of literature, both in and out of the church in the 19th and 20th centuries, that was devoted to this whole business of the practicing of the virtues. And the thought was that these virtues could be habituated into character. Indeed, here in America, one of the real shocks that happened to our culture in the 60s was the discovery that parents had made that their children apparently were not being habituated into the virtues in our universities and colleges. Au contraire. What they saw on television, their sweet young kids, was not what they had expected. What they had expected was that higher education would, in a sense, be an arm of virtue. Now, I know it's hard to believe that any longer, but or to believe what I'm saying, but it is actually true. So where did these absolutes come from? Well, there's no question that some of them at least had come from the Enlightenment. And as the Enlightenment has begun to crumble, the Enlightenment ideology is losing its hold on American life, where are these moral norms going to be found? And so bit by bit, the whole structure has begun to come down. And in the absence of an alternative way of finding these moral norms, people have moved from talking about virtues now to talking about values. And values are little more than just personal preferences. We treat values today in a very value-free way. Values in our privatized, individual existence is what we prize or think is important. And one person's set of values could be entirely different from another. And then finally, the shift from guilt to shame. Now, I know we use these words interchangeably, at least in the church and in Christian faith sometimes. But today, as the discussion has emerged, these are developing a different set of meanings. Guilt is what has traditionally lined up who we are or our actions with a moral norm, traditionally God himself. It therefore has a vertical dimension. As shame is being talked about today, it is almost wholly understood in a horizontal direction. Shame is the sense of awkwardness that a person may feel if somebody knows something about them or sees them doing something. And we all know that there is shame that's of a non-moral kind too. A person might feel embarrassed because they had come out of a poor neighborhood and they wouldn't want people perhaps to know where they had come from. That sense of embarrassment before others, that is shame. Guilt needs forgiveness. Shame merely needs therapy. So, nature to self, character to personality, virtues to values, guilt to shame. Now, it's the first of these that I'm still trying to focus on a little bit, the nature to self. Here is a chicken and egg question. Was it the shift from nature to self? Was it the shift that has led us throughout the West to adopt a psychologized view of the world? A view of the world as seen through the peephole of the self? Or was it a psychologized view of the world with its very heavy therapeutic overlay, which inclined us to think about ourselves as selves? Well, perhaps we don't even need to answer that question. But here is something that we do need to see very clearly, that what has happened as we have moved from thinking about ourselves in terms of human nature, even human nature in the image of God, to the self, what has happened is that we have made a profoundly religious move. This is nicely captured in the title of Paul Witz's earlier book, Psychology as Religion, or more recently, I guess it was last year, Christina Hoff Sommer's book, One Nation Under Therapy. From nature to self. And contrary to what postmoderns are thinking, many of them, the idea of the autonomous self, which is of the essence of the way in which we are now thinking about ourselves, this was not simply an Enlightenment aberration. It's a very important point to see in terms of the way people are understanding themselves. There's a great deal made today by postmoderns of the fact that they are, well, of their postness. They're not moderns. They're not Enlightenment types. They are postmoderns. They think that the entire Enlightenment project has been overturned. They are now beyond it. They are postmoderns. This has entered the talk that we hear in the emerging church too. Of course, they are not moderns. They're not like the Willow Creek crowd. They are postmoderns. You get this in Neo, for example, in McLaren's book, A New Kind of Christian. But I think there is a very strong argument to be made that this understanding of the self as autonomous, is actually one of the major continuing contributions from the Enlightenment that didn't die with the dying of modernity, but has continued into the postmodern ethos. Let me try to sketch this for you. And this is now my third point, if you're keeping count. In 1784, Immanuel Kant wrote his famous essay entitled, What is the Enlightenment? And he sought to give an answer to that question. And it's very simple. Kant said that the essence of the Enlightenment was freedom, freedom from the past, freedom from God, freedom from authority, freedom from every system of belief which would limit or curtail the innovations of the Enlightenment. Freedom, therefore, from anything which was fixed, eternal, unchanging, that would place restraints on what could be thought, said, or done during the Enlightenment period. Kant argued in that famous essay that this was of the essence of maturity, because when you have children or are yourself a child, you're told what to do. And in Europe, people had been told what to do. In other words, they had been limited and curtailed. This, Kant said in that essay, had proved to be a tiresome ball and chain that they had dragged around on their foot. It had impeded their progress. The time had now come to throw this off. They were emancipated. And so it was, as Richard Tarnas has written, the modern person began to emerge, and I'm now quoting him, began to emerge as newly self-conscious and autonomous being, skeptical of orthodoxies, rebellious against authority, responsible for his own beliefs and actions, assured of his intellectual capacity to comprehend and control nature, and altogether less dependent on an omnipotent God. Well, actually, not dependent on an omnipotent God at all. Here, in a nutshell, is the Enlightenment ideology, and here is the profile of the modern person. And we do need to see that what's happened here is that we have the emerging, and I'm going to make this point in a second in a slightly different way. What we have emerging here is a kind of inverted religious quest during the Enlightenment period. Yes, the Enlightenment was stridently anti-Christian. It was stridently anti-clerical. The church was the bête noire. It was the beast. But what you have, I think, emerging here is a different kind of religion in which all that had been formerly found in God would now be found in the autonomous self, that the human being would find all of his or her meaning, mystery, and morality within themselves. It was a profound idolatry. So it seems to me that it's a very small step to take, and indeed a very natural movement from Immanuel Kant's Enlightenment man to psychological man of the modern period to psychological man who is now spiritual in the postmodern moment. Postmoderns, we are told, have a number of characteristics in the way they think. They are post-objective. They reject private individual objectivity, in which people set themselves off from the world around them and, as it were, set themselves off from themselves and analyze themselves. You can't do that anymore. They're post-critical. They reject the Enlightenment called Enlightenment dichotomy between true and false. Postmoderns are into congruence. They're more into stories than didactic teaching. And postmoderns are said to be post-secular. That is, over against the rationalists and the naturalists of the Enlightenment period, postmoderns are spiritual. They're very interested in spirituality. Now, it is true that in the postmoderns, you do have a rejection of the Enlightenment rationalism and so forth. And it is certainly true that we have a remarkably different situation today, culturally, than people were thinking would be the case 30 or 40 years ago. I can actually remember the literature of the 70s and 80s rather clearly. That was for and against secular humanism. And the proponents of it were arguing in typical Enlightenment fashion with their doctrine of progress. They were arguing that the time was at hand when the map was going to be wiped clean of all religions and all spiritualities. But it hasn't turned out that way. And this is true throughout the West, not simply here in the United States. All of a sudden, we have become very spiritual. 80% of Americans say they are spiritual. 60-odd percent say their spirituality is very important to them. Peter Berger, the Boston sociologist, has this rather delightful way of conceptualizing this. He says, yes, of course, secular humanistic attitudes have become entrenched in pockets in our culture, the elite pockets. It's certainly in academia, certainly in Hollywood, in some of our newspapers, and so on. So you have these pockets of rationalistic, naturalistic, secular humanistic attitudes. But that's not where the great majority of Americans are. So he says, America is a little bit like a Sweden presiding over an India. But here is an important point about all of this spirituality. On the surface, you may think, this is so different from the Enlightenment. And yet, is it? For a vast number of people today, God, or the sacred, or the ultimate, whatever it is they have that makes them spiritual, is so privatized, has become so domesticated, that it really is an extension of themselves. Indeed, it is what secures their autonomy as selves. It does not check, confront, rein in their autonomy. It undergirds it. And therefore, yes, it's true, postmoderns all of a sudden are spiritual and the secular humanists of the Enlightenment time were not. The secular humanists argued as a very centerpiece of their revolution for the autonomy of the self. But has that autonomy been yielded? Has it changed simply because it is now more spiritual, whereas once it wasn't? I don't think so. No, I think this is a continuing thread. And it goes through from the modern period right into our contemporary moment. And there are other things that we could add to this, which I think really do or should change the way we are thinking about postmoderns, at least just a little bit. Take this matter of a worldview. Now, if you remember Kuyper's three points in this whole matter of how we conceive of ourselves as knowing, experiencing subjects, that is a very important part of how we structure a worldview which takes account of what we're thinking there. A lot of postmodern authors have tried to differentiate themselves from moderns by saying, moderns thought in terms of worldviews. We who know so much more about ourselves, we are so much more skeptical about our knowing processes, so we cannot have worldviews. But when you think about it, it is true, you certainly can find people in the Enlightenment ideology who thought with crystal clarity and who had very sharply conceived worldviews. But I don't think most people in the West who have lived under the aegis of modernization have that sort of clarity. Most probably muddled their minds, filled with the stuff of everyday life. If you ask them about a worldview, it would probably be something along the lines of being optimistic that things are getting better and better, that they believed in taking the spoils of modern conquest, something about affluence. Affluence has produced a kind of gospel. To have is to be, to have not is to be damned. But within all of this, there has been a worm in the apple. Now, this is simply my read on it. Because while it is the case that we who live in the modernized West and have benefited so much from its plenty, and we have, I'm reminded every year when I go to Africa to work with orphans, I'm reminded of what is not there in comparison to what is here, of being in homes where I know that I have eaten their food, and they sometimes don't know where another meal's coming from. We in the West have lived with great plenty, and it is the product of our capitalism and our technology and the way we've organized our society around production and indeed consumption. But now, here is something that is interesting. As we move into this sort of era of high capitalism, of super consumption, there are certain characteristics that intrude upon our psyches almost every day. And these are the characteristics of our fast-moving, rapidly creating products, rapidly replacing products kind of capitalism. Words like volatility, obsolescence, the rapid passing of fashions and ideas, the disappearance of stability, constant innovation, constant revision, repackaging, the new look, the newer the new product. Is it unreasonable to think that the character of this world of consumption that we inhabit and inhabit in our minds, is it unreasonable to think that this world of consumption imparts some of its character to us? Because when you think about it, the very characteristics that I talked about, the obsolescence, the rapid passing of ideas and fads and fashions and so forth, this is of the essence of the postmodern mind. Because people do not experience the world as something that is fixed, unchanging, as having absolutes in it. They experience the world as something that is shifting, fleeting, passing, undergoing constant innovation, renovation, etc. So here is yet another one of these very interesting things to note. That postmoderns, who I think are adapting what they think they can know to the world with which they are so familiar psychologically, are actually as much part and parcel of the modernized world as the Enlightenment types and the moderns whom they reject. Well, I need to return to my three points in Kuiper. The three corners of our worldview concerning our understanding of God, our understanding of ourselves, and our understanding of the world. Under the postmodern sun, I believe we have become way too modest. We are overwhelmed by our own subjectivity. We have become jaundiced in our view of our reason. And we find ourselves oftentimes adrift in a world that we think that we cannot know. And it is interesting to reflect on this for a second. Yes, each person's internal disposition is a filter through which they read and perceive reality. But am I mistaken in thinking that this used to be called presuppositions? And this long before postmoderns were around? Yes, of course it's true that our reasoning process can be very self-serving. But am I mistaken in thinking that this used to be included under discussion about total depravity? That it is our head, along with our heart, that is corrupted? Yes, we do turn the world upside down. We do falsely rationalize about it. But isn't this what used to be in view when people talked about sin? So I'm just not persuaded that all of these insights that postmoderns are suddenly having are actually that new. And as a matter of fact, I'm not sure they're that helpful. Far better, it seems to me, and indeed far more hopeful, to place yourselves, for us to place ourselves within a biblical framework, where we say to ourselves that we're not imprisoned and we're not locked up within our own wretched subjectivity, but God is big enough and powerful enough and gracious enough and willing enough to liberate us so that we can in fact confront reality. And we can know him not simply as a notion in our minds, but for what he is, as the object of norm and the independent source of meaning and the giver of meaning to life. And we can say to ourselves that we are hopeful people because it is grace that enables us to take back our place in creation, to be subordinate to him, dependent upon him, both as our creator and our meaning giver. And much of that meaning in life derives from the moral structure of things. It derives from that architecture grounded in his being as holy love. And these are objective norms of right and wrong. They're not simply my reflections upon life. And so our thoughts, as they follow his, can actually be a reflection and a correspondence to what is there. Because our redemption is a redemption from all that distorts, and our redemption is a liberation into all that is true. And is this not good news in a postmodern age that has become altogether too epistemologically modest for its own good?